Hey listeners, this is your host, Abir Sichter. This episode of Local Global Leaders is titled Relentless Advocate for Students and Opportunity. And I sat down with Kelly McManus, Vice President of Higher Education at Arnold Ventures. Kelly is a fellow Teach for America alum whose values were shaped early on by her family, especially her dad, who's a football coach. She's lived with the belief that to whom much is given, much is expected. We discussed how that grounding led her to a deep understanding of privilege and a lifelong commitment to expanding access to high-quality education. We also talked about how lessons from the football field and her time as an educator continue to inform her leadership and advocacy today. Now, here's our conversation. Greetings, everybody. This is Abir Sichter, and I'm here with another episode of Local Global Leaders with Kelly McManus. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's really great to be with an educational leader like you, fellow teacher. Really excited to get to hear about your teaching background and to have my first guest to come to us from outside of Kentucky. So it'll be really great to hear the work you're doing and how that is incorporated here in Kentucky.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. But first, we want to hear kind of about your journey or your leadership development journey and how you became to be such a great leader. Want to start out with your six-word story. What are six words you'd use to describe yourself?
I would say the six words that I would use to describe myself are educator, focused. I'm going to jump between like nouns and verbs. So educator, focused, loyal, ambitious, empathetic, and then football.
Oh.
Yeah. That's another one for me.
A little wild card in there.
Yeah, a little bit of a wild card.
I assume, is that American-style football? Or?
It is American-style football, yes. My dad was a college football coach for 35 years. Uh-huh. My brother and my brother-in-law are college football coaches. And so, actually, when we think about leadership, a lot of how I developed came from that context and that growing up in that environment, being a part of that environment.
Oh, wow. That's so awesome. And can you, with that, that's the perfect segue to my next question, to tell us more into your leadership journey and what eventually got you into the higher education policy space.
So, like I said, my dad was a college football coach when I was growing up. I'm from North Carolina, and we were, when I was in middle school, in sixth grade, my dad got another job, and we moved from a more affluent part of North Carolina to a more rural, much less affluent part of North Carolina. And I saw, from as soon as we got there, that the quality of school that I got access to was very, very different from what I had gotten in Winston-Salem. I was 12 years old, and my parents were having to fight for me to get opportunities to access the advanced classes. The school district was just not set up, despite, I had some great teachers there, but the system was not set up to enable students to move at the pace that they needed to move. And for me, I saw my parents they were tenacious, they were relentless, they advocated for me. My mom ended up taking a year off of work so that she could drive me from the high school to the middle school. So one drive, 5 miles a day. But she, fortunately, we were in the position where she could do that. But it should never require parents to be superheroes in order for students to get access to a high quality education. And so I was, age 12, and I was like, this is wrong. And and that became my thing. I was like, this is all in the same state. There should not be these kinds of disparities. And so I went throughout the rest of my high school career, college career, I really focused on trying to understand how the system had come to be the way that it was, trying to understand the policy. I learned very early on that, and I'm not entirely sure how actually, but that I gravitate towards policy as the means of change. I think that I see when you can drive change at scale, the way to do that and the way to make that sustainable is through policy change. So I wanted to go into education policy, and no one would hire me coming out of undergrad. I, you know, had a liberal arts degree with no real policy experience, and I thought that I was ready to like take on the world. And I actually found a letter that I had written to Senator Burr, who was my senator at the time, who was on the health committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee in the Senate, and asked him to help me get an interview for a policy advisor job, which now that I have worked in D.C. for over a decade, and I know like that was a unbelievably naive and ridiculous ask, and I didn't hear back, and rightfully so. But I think that that was a real lesson to me that I needed more experience, and I needed more. I needed to really understand how things work. So I had a professor. I went to Wake Forest. I had a professor at Wake who really suggested that if I wanted to be a good policymaker and a good policy leader, that I needed experience in the classroom. And so that's what took me to Teach for America. I taught middle school English in Philadelphia. And I will say there is nothing, like there is no job that will ever be harder than that. And so everything now is just, it's gravy. I mean, compared to that, compared to having to, you know, even sitting in front of my board now and having to pitch things, I'm like, y'all are nothing compared to the, you know, 12 and 13 year olds that I had to face every day. And I, so again, I had such wonderful, talented students who were given, they were just dealt a tough hand. And they were trying to figure themselves out as people. You know, middle school is terrible for everybody. So, but I think particularly when you are living in poverty, when you are dealing with some of the impacts of, you know, of systemic racism, when you are, I had a lot of students who were immigrants and refugees from West Africa. And so there were just, there were lots of levels of challenges that my students were facing. And I recognized, you know, just even, I mean, I was not a particularly good teacher. learned that I feel like I was always meant to be on the policy side, but they deserved so much better than me, and they deserved so much better than the system that they were in. And so that has been my my journey. And so fast forward, I did eventually move into policy. And moved to D.C. And was brought to D.C. By one of my mentors and really kind of leadership idols, Katie Haycock, who was the founder of the Education Trust. And Katie, is just to me like the ideal, like relentless advocate for students and for opportunity. And she brought me in, and we worked on reauthorizing No Child Left Behind, the Every Student Succeeds Act, in 2015. And after we did that, I had kind of a moment of reflection where, you know, we passed a law. I mean, I didn't pass it. Congress passed a law. We worked on it. That set up a system where maybe some good things at the state level could happen. But I don't know that any student's life is better because of the Every Student Succeeds Act. It was so far removed. And I think this is one of the biggest kind of misnomers or misunderstandings about education policy. It's really, I mean, the federal government, yes, they get a lot of attention for talking about K-12, but what the policy actually is, like, it's a very, very far removed from what a lot of students experience in the classroom. Most of the, like, importance of the standards, the, you know, the teachers in the classroom, those are state and local decisions. And so I was a little disillusioned with my ability to have an impact on improving students' lives at the federal level. But at the same time, EdTrust I was working also was doing higher ed work. And so I, as their lobbyist, as the government affairs person, I got to go in and advocate. We were working on increasing the Pell Grant at the time and protecting Pell. And we were able to get increases in Pell. We were able to get Pell restored so you could use it year round. So students who needed to go in the summer could have access to it. We were able to get Pell Grants restored for students who were incarcerated. And that those were tangible impacts on students' lives. That was making more money for low-income students, was making their lives better, not just like maybe down the road, but immediately. And that really drew me for, you know, for as long as I am doing federal level work, I want to stay in the higher ed space because there is so much more direct impact that the federal government has on higher ed than it does in K-12. So that's what brought me to higher ed. Very long-winded story.
That's an amazing story. I can definitely relate to like your teaching experience. I also did Teach for America in Memphis, so I felt a lot of the same things you were feeling. I'm like, yeah, my students deserve better. I definitely was not a great teacher. I stayed for a third year, fortunately for them, and or unfortunately, but I think that year I did a lot better. And I relate a lot to like I want to try to make a change outside the classroom because I mean I think a lot of teachers can make that change, but it's just hard, like really hard to do that. And I've told exact stories, so many people I've told of like that was the hardest job I'll ever have.
By far, That's it. Also, I would say taught me a lot about lobbying. It taught me a lot about politics. Like all of it is, it's all trying to get people to do things they don't want to do necessarily. And nobody is a harder audience than a middle schooler. So even the most recalcitrant senator, like, come on. You're nothing compared to my students.
The challenge is really helping. I went to law school right after Teach for America, and I'm like, it wasn't that bad.
No,
like it really wasn't after
exactly
the teacher.
Exactly.
Yeah. But it sounds like you have so many motivations that drew this from like your personal experience to like having your parents who really cared about education. I also relate to that too. My parents really pushed for me to get a good education, went out of their way to give me like extra opportunities. Mm-hmm. So like, it's just amazing to hear how like you took that personal experience, you took your teaching experience, and you know you're still using that policy experience to like make the changes you want to make.
Well, I think that was one of the things that my parents really, they taught me early, and they really held us to is, we have been so privileged, and it's very much that idea of like those to whom much is given, much is expected, and that is how. How my parents raised me, and it's something that I think service. I don't remember who said, but service is the rent we pay for living. And I think that's really a driving force for me.
That's a great driving force. With the work you're doing, like focusing on so many different areas of education, from like investing in it to policy advocacy, even like litigation. How do you like navigate measuring and working on all those different portfolios?
It's really hard to say, and this is the challenge in working in policy. These are entrenched, long-standing challenges that we are trying to address. Things like making sure that students who go to higher ed graduate with a degree or credential that is going to set them up for success in the job market, which is what 95%, 99% of students report. That's why they go to higher ed is to help improve their job outlooks. And so I think that we have our systems, even at higher ed, our system was not built for everybody to go to higher ed. Higher ed was founded for an elite population. And I think that as we have progressed and we've opened access to higher ed, we are seeing more and more people go, which is important. But if they aren't getting access to high quality, and if they aren't getting the opportunities that we say, we tell our students, college is a pathway to the middle class. You should be thinking about this. But if we are sending students to schools that have, you know, deeply low graduation rates, where more students are defaulting on their loans than are graduating, like that's a lie. We are lying to students about what that opportunity is. And so these are deep-seated problems that don't have quick solutions. I think that there are some things that make sense, that basic things like if more of your students default on loans than graduate, like you are doing something wrong and you do not deserve, you know, to be subsidized, publicly subsidized by taxpayers and by students. So there are some policies that we think are pretty straightforward, like ending those subsidies for predatory, very low quality institutions. But there's still, you know, I say a lot, people don't necessarily realize that our average graduation rate in higher ed is, depending on the sector, but it hovers around 60% nationally. And if that was a high school, it would be considered a dropout factory, that, you know, more than a third of students are not completing their credential. And so there is a lot of room to improve, but you can't turn this ship overnight, a ship that has been built without ever, you know, the conversation about outcomes in higher ed is relatively new. We had been really focused on access for a long time, which made a lot of sense. But now we're seeing, we are actually putting a lot of money as a country into our higher ed system. Just, you know, just Pell Grants and student loans are over $100 billion every year. And so that's a lot of money. And we need to be thinking about, okay, how are we making sure that students, when a school admits a student, that the school feels a sense of responsibility to that student to help them succeed. I think that those are problems that you can't turn on a dime. Graduation rates can't go up. Even if you get, you know, a great leader, a great turnaround leader who is really committed to student success and is focused on getting students, you know, through to completion of a credential of value, it will take several years. I mean, that they have new students that come in. We're looking at, you know, an 8-year window before you can really see the kind of dramatic progress. And so I think the way that I think about it is kind of, what are the incremental steps? Like, if there was a silver bullet, we would have found it. I think that's true in most things. And so what are the incremental steps? How can we keep building on a foundation? And when I think about, you know, supporting the Arnolds and supporting Arnold Ventures and helping them allocate their resources, it is really about, for me, helping them to understand the trade-offs, that this might move the needle this much. This might move the needle more, but it is riskier, it's longer, it is. And then we have to make those trade-offs how much we want to push on the different potential levers. And so it's a very complex system of trade-offs that you just do the best you can, really.
Yeah. And with your work with higher education, how much do you look at like supporting students who go into apprenticeships or career technical education opportunities?
That's one of the really exciting things that we are expanding out. I think this has been, we have just launched in the last year a new portfolio around career pathways. And I think that is one of the things that we have seen just over and over, that, you know, the data are clear that for now, a bachelor's degree is still the best bet for economic opportunity and mobility. But there are a lot of, that is not universal. There are still too many degrees, too many institutions that don't pay off. And there cannot be, if we are going to truly like be a country of opportunity, there cannot be one pathway. That is just not a viable way for us to operate. And so we are investing. We're really excited. There are some new models out there, the apprenticeship degree model, mm-hmm. Where people are blending apprenticeships and bachelor's degree programs. We're really excited about those. I think we are also seeing that that the conversation around outcomes, there's still work to be done in the CTE and apprenticeship space to, again, make sure that we are giving students access to high quality apprenticeships that lead to, you know, significant economic opportunity, same with CTE, that it's not just kind of more is more and let's hope that students end up okay, but let's actually look at the data, let's look at the evidence, let's see how people are doing and how do we invest more in those things that are working, and stop investing in the things that are not providing opportunities for people.
Yeah, it's a lot of things to think about. What are, like, with all these like different, like all these different topics and all the different like diverse aspects of your work, I'm curious what have been like the biggest struggles even you've encountered in your leadership journey, whether like in your current position or in prior positions?
I would say that by far the biggest struggle that I have, and I think it's one that I would imagine is fairly common. I would imagine you have heard about it before in this podcast. I really struggle with letting go and delegation. I have the most incredible team that I work with that I'm so fortunate, and they are so wonderful and capable and qualified, and I am their biggest barrier because I am... I have grown up as the perfectionist, you know, oldest daughter, all of those stereotypes. And it's very hard for me to let go. And I have had to, and this is something I've been working on over the past few years, is realizing that when I don't give them opportunities to run with things, when I don't delegate, when I hold on to things too much, I'm hurting them. Mm-hmm. I'm hurting myself too, but I need to reframe it to think about, like, these are talented people who deserve opportunities to shine, and I'm taking that away from them. And that gets at kind of my motivation. I'm like, no, that's not what I want to do. I want to give them opportunities. And just starting to reframe that has been helpful. They will tell you I have a long way to go in terms of that. But I do think that that transition from the doer to the manager or the leader, I think that's a really, really hard one. I think it's particularly hard for women, especially women who have been high achievers, who have gotten really good feedback for the quality of their work. And it's an ongoing learning lesson for me.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I mean, I've had that in my career somewhat recently for the past few years. Like I said, going from that doer, going from like that like analyst level to like being a manager, like leading product, it's tough to adapt to.
It's tough. And I started, you know, this has been, my team has grown recently, but, you know, for a while it was mostly me and one other person. That has been learning how to, as the team has grown and as the work has gotten more complex, as the work has grown too, it is really reframing that this is how we drive the biggest impact, is by giving people the opportunity to run in the ways that I know that they can do.
Yeah. It's really important to, like, you said that letting go, there is a way to do that where you can really empower people.
Exactly. My colleagues are just phenomenal, and it's a real, I'm learning, you know, just how much kind of joy it brings to see them thrive, and it makes me want to give them more opportunities to do so.
That's great. Have you ever encountered toxic leadership in your career, and like, what have you learned from experiences with that?
I have. Again, I think that there have been several times in my career where I think it has been hard for some of the people that I have seen and experienced a level of competitiveness that I think is unhealthy. And I think that particularly in the nonprofit sector, you know, we are all driven by wanting to have an impact. That is why we are there. And I think that sometimes that can bleed into people thinking that almost like going into savior mode and thinking about, and I would assume that this is slightly different in the nonprofit space than it is in other spaces where, you know, you're there because you have a heart for the mission, the issue that you're working on. But it becomes more about you and it becomes more like egotistical. It's like, well, I can make the world a better place. I'm doing this. And that leads to deeply, you know, competitive. I think that when I have seen that, I've had to really take a step back and say, okay, what is this about? This is mostly not about me. This is mostly about the other person. And they are mostly trying to, like, you know, we are working hard. We're not making perhaps as much as some of our peers are. This is something about how they are interpreting their self-worth. This is not about me. And disassociating from that and trying to stay above the fray, it's really challenging. I wouldn't say that I have figured it out by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that that there is probably an under-discussed toxicity and competitiveness in the nonprofit space that I hope people can start to explore more.
I can say I've definitely been guilty of that, of like thinking I'm the one who has to make this change, or like I care the most.
I care the most. Champion. Exactly. Yeah. This is, and it's, you know, and it comes from a good place ultimately, but it becomes a very toxic drive. Yeah.
And have you seen any shifts in that, or even more competitiveness recently? I know that with like funding being, because I've seen this with my work, like that nonprofit, like are they competing even more, example, for funding?
I think absolutely. And that really worries me. I think that the scarcity mindset is always, always bad. But I think it's getting worse. And I think right now there is very much a feeling of a zero sum game. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of funders that are stepping up and funding more. I think there are other funders that are kind of rethinking how they are doing. And we are really at Arnold Ventures, really growing our state level work right now. And I think but not from kind of a zero sum game. It's just thinking about, we are policy funders. The Arnolds are very focused on policy change, and there are opportunities at the state level to drive change, and so we are exploring those, and just why I'm here in Kentucky right now. But I think that there is one of the things that I am really hopeful about, it is that, you know, scarcity can breed that competitiveness. They can also breed new opportunities, new ways of thinking, new partnerships, really like thinking critically of like, actually, should we be working together in this way? How can we complement each other? And so I think that there's an opportunity and space for creativity, but it's a very challenging time to think creatively.
I like the themes you've mentioned of like thinking about that competitiveness. You mentioned like letting go earlier. With thinking about all those, like, what would you say is your leadership style or philosophy?
I think that I take a lot from both of my parents in this regard. So my dad is kind of that very stereotypical old school football coach who is direct. He made it very clear, like, when we were growing up, when we would talk to him about things, like, you know, this is... this is just your job, this is what you do, you know, and if you don't, very frankly, if like you are not, you don't owe your job anything, your job doesn't owe you anything, this is like a contractual relationship here. And I've had to work on kind of internalizing that, but being very straightforward about kind of none of us are here to retire anymore. Like the job has certain, no, very few people are staying at the same place anymore. So what makes sense for you in this moment? And sometimes that is the job you already have. Sometimes it's something else. And so I think that I've really embraced the, like, let's be very straightforward. But also, you know, my mom was an early childhood educator. She was, just on the outside, inside too, just sweetest, warmest, but she was a force to be reckoned with, like behind the scenes in a quiet way. And she and my dad, really made some significant sacrifices in their careers, especially my dad's career, to prioritize family. And that really stuck with me as well. And I think the lesson that I got from my mom, and that I think is that it is, nothing matters more than your family, like, and who you are as a person. And so a job is just a job. Like, you want to give it your all, you want to succeed, you want to win, and it's just a job. And you have to be able to let it go. And so when I think about my leadership, it is, how do we focus on getting done what we can get done while also being people, putting the people first, thinking about who are we as people, what motivates us, what drives us, what do we need to do to be good people, to be our best selves, and how do we like cut through and just be as straightforward, you know, clear as kind. How do we do that in a way, but that honors people's humanity? I don't know if that answered your question.
Yes. I think that there's, I like how you ended on humanity, like thinking about just the people first.
Yeah.
And do you consider yourself someone who leads more with like your head or your heart?
They are in constant tension. I think that ultimately I lead with my head and then my heart agonizes over it.
I love that. With my own leadership philosophy, I have sort of three simple M's I always like to ask about, and they're being an effective motivator, a competent manager, and then a supportive mentor. So like motivation, management, and mentorship. How do you view those like three roles, those three aspects of leadership? Do you see them as like three things tied together or three distinct things, and like how do you approach them?
I think that I picture them very much as a Venn diagram, and so I think that they are all integrally connected to each other. I think you can be one without the other two, but I think that you miss opportunities to really invest in people and to grow as yourself. I mean, I know that I have grown the most when I've been mentoring people, you know, when I have been able to be that like really effective manager who helps people, like who sets clear expectations, who supports them, but then holds them accountable. Like that has been a growth journey for me, but it's also helped the people that I have worked with. And so I think that I really love that, those three, and I truly do picture them as kind of a big Venn diagram altogether.
And do you have, of the three, do you have a favorite?
No, I like them all. No, I do. I mean, certainly I think mentoring is the most rewarding. Mm-hmm. But I actually think that I probably excel the most as the manager. Oh. Yeah.
That's interesting. I appreciate you answering all those questions about your journey and your background in leadership. Now I'm going to ask this next part, I'm going to ask a handful of questions about sort of local global context of your work and some fun questions as well. But it's so great that we have you here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Can you tell us what's brought you here and the work you're doing here?
Absolutely. So I am here for the Kentucky Chamber. The Chamber of Commerce yesterday had their legislative preview. And we were really excited. So Kentucky is a state in the higher ed space, I will say, that is very, very well known and well respected for your data system in particular. KY Stats, big shout out to KY Stats and to the team that is working on that. That is truly, I said this yesterday, it is the envy of a lot of states. People are like, can you send us to Kentucky so we can learn from them? And I'm not sure why you like what you can see when you travel to see a data system, but that's fine. And so I think what we are really thinking about is, and our approach, our theory of change is that we want to work with states to help them identify, use their own data to identify which credentials are providing the most value, the most economic opportunity for students. And Kentucky is so well positioned there because of the quality of your data. You can look and see, you know, where are students falling through the cracks? Where are the programs that students are taking on too much debt commensurate to what they are going to make? And then with that data, you can really start to have interesting conversations about, okay, maybe this program we're charging too much for. And so maybe we need to bring down, you know, that this is something like, you know, an early child care worker. Like, those are low paying jobs. We absolutely should have a conversation about how we pay our child care providers more and early childhood educators more, because there is nothing more important, I would argue, than keeping our young kids safe and giving them opportunity. But that is not a problem for higher ed to solve necessarily. That is a broader society thing. So why are we having students go into debt for that? Mm-hmm. If we know that this is a program where you know your rewards are not necessarily going to be financial, how can we make some of those adjustments to make sure that students who are pursuing higher ed are better off than they otherwise would have been? So that's part of why I am here, is to talk. I think that y'all have a real opportunity to continue being a leader, leveraging your data to see, like, how do we really make sure, again, that every student who goes to higher ed is better off than they otherwise would have been.
That's great. I appreciate that shout out for our data system. I'm very proud of that personally. I mean, as a Kentuckian, as an economics major, as a math teacher, I'm just like, yes, that's yes. Everything you want to see.
Exactly. Exactly. And there's still opportunities to build on it. I think one of the things, you know, there are ways to deep dive so that you know that not just who somebody works for, but kind of what kind of job they are getting. I think there are ways that you can then get, like, really, you could better understand the various pathways. And I think that also helps students think about, okay, well, I know I want to be this job over here or in this field. What are some of the pathways that, how do I think about, like, okay, does an apprenticeship make sense for me? Does a community college, starting at a community college, make sense? Or should I go to a 4-year, and then what should I major in? Like, the more that we are able to give students those tools, I think the better we will end up in terms of making sure that higher ed, you know, is actually fulfilling its role of giving people opportunity.
And thinking of those roles, like, what do you think of our system and, like, I guess how we prepare students for jobs? And in particular, I always think with my family, like, my parents are from Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. My dad especially, like, didn't understand of, like, oh, I don't have to pick my career in seventh grade.
Right.
Like, and they were like, oh, take this class and that class. And I mean, people here can, I mean, you can major in something and do something completely different. I mean, because I studied economics, I didn't take any teaching master's or degree, right, but I still taught. Like, do you think, I like it, but obviously the flaws in it. So
yes.
I guess, like, I don't know, like, what do you think about the way we align, I guess, education and workforce?
It's really interesting, and I think that's when people get really excited about, you know, the German or the Swiss model of apprenticeships or other internationally. And we have a different structure that, where you are not making your choice, and you shouldn't make your choice when you are in seventh grade or even in high school. You know, there is a reason why graduation rates in other countries are so much higher, and it's because, like, only the people on a particular track go to higher ed. We have chosen, and I think rightly so, that we want to give people the opportunity to, you know, to manifest. With that structure, it is incumbent on us. We do people a disservice if we don't give them the information to make an informed choice. When we send a message to students, which we do right now, that, okay, if you can take out a Pell Grant for this or take out loans for this, that there's, you know, a federal government seal of approval. This must be a legit program. There are far too many programs out there that are just preying on students, that are not, and we do not need, like, having opportunity, having those choices doesn't mean that just anybody should get to, you know, claim to be an institution and offer student loans to students. Like, there is an obligation, I think, to make outcomes data very clear, and then to make sure that we aren't subsidizing programs that consistently leave people worse off. So I think that I prefer our system. I think having those choices is right, but you need to have a functioning market where you have outcomes so you can make smart decisions.
Are there any books or publications that have shaped your leadership philosophy and journey?
I was thinking about this and I really had a hard time thinking of something. I mean, I think that I'm a voracious reader, but I very purposely do not read like leadership books. I stick to like fiction for the most part, or history. And then it is, this is one of my like weird, I'm not a movie person.
Oh.
I don't watch movies. It's very strange. So I struggle with that. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, it sounds like you don't need any leadership books to read about all the great work you're doing. Are there any local or global leaders you look up to, whether real figures or any fictional leaders?
I will say, you know, Katie Haycock, who I mentioned before, is just a leadership icon for me. I think that she was someone who said the tough things and who had really hard conversations, but always put what was going to give students' opportunities first. She was talking about equity like from before a lot of other people were, when it was still a scary thing to talk about. She was the one who was saying, no, we have to look at how we are serving students. And even if your average as a school looks good, like you're, you know, on either graduation rates or test scores or anything like this, but there are systemic gaps in performance. Like, you cannot be a good school if you do not serve all students well. And she, just her fearlessness, but also her pragmatism. She worked very closely with people on both sides of the aisle, and she got things done. And I think that she was also operating in a time where, like, more things got done in general. But she, to me, just is someone that I think about all the time, as, you know, and I think, what would Katie do? And I aspire to live up to that.
That's amazing. It's an awesome role model to look up to. And we started this interview with your 6-word story. Now I want to end it with your 6-word legacy. What are 6 words you want people to envision when they think of you and your impact, like locally, but also here in the world?
Opportunity, value, family, fun. Maybe still football. and people.
And actually, one last question. Who's your favorite football team?
Oh, so it's whoever is paying my family at the time. So right now, but no, I'm a Wake Forest Demon Deacon at heart. But right now, I am also an East Carolina Pirate. And I am also at Presbyterian College Blue Hose, who are having the best season in history right now.
Wow.
So we're very, very proud of them.
Awesome. Sounds like great teams. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us. I know that you had a busy schedule. Thank you for coming here to Kentucky and sharing your work, and thank you for being a guest in the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all that y'all are doing in Kentucky, and I'm just so excited to see what more we can all do together.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That wraps up my conversation with Kelly McManus. I love talking with her about two of my greatest passions, education and public policy. And it was especially meaningful to hear her reflect on the ongoing learning that comes with becoming a leader and how her time as an educator still drives the meaningful work that she does today. And I loved to hear her perspective on Kentucky leadership and education, particularly in how we creatively use student data. My next episode drops in April, and it features McKenna Dowell, the student body president at the University of Kentucky. Until then, remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.